delight today because we get State Senator Keith Gainer in studio with us to take a look back at the legislative session. And I'm sure you've got some things that maybe we didn't hear as much about, Senator Gainer, but thanks for joining us. Boy, I'm sure the folks in the Republicans feel like they're just meeting an immovable force over in Olympia with just the disparity over in both chambers, all the elected state positions. It's almost one party control, isn't it?
Well, it is one party control. When you say it's an immovable force, I would say that it's a moving force because we have seen so much change in the last 2 years. Last year, we went into session with I think it was like 10 or 12 billion deficit that they were trying to fill. We ended up with $9 billion of new taxes, and that was the first year of the biennium. Came back this year, it was supposed to be a supplemental, just kind of tweak the edges of all the budgets and maybe a little bit of legislation. We end up with another $3 billion, you know, that we're trying to find revenue for. And, you know, there's just this never-ending desire, this insatiable desire for more revenue without really being accountable for the way the money's being spent right now.
And I understand there's a lot of moving money around, including some pension money in the future to try and solve this deficit, because it went up another $2 billion, but there's a lot of money being moved around here over the next couple of years.
Well, the pension you're referring to is the left one, which is law enforcement and firefighters pension fund. And they are the elderly retirees right now. And so that pool is diminishing annually. But that money was set aside for those individuals. And it does appear that it is overfunded. But the reality is that, you know, we want to make sure that there isn't an issue for them. So number one, guarantee that they do have the pensions that are promised to them. But then also, if you are going to start moving money from pension funds, there needs to be a clear path as to why it's being used and for what, you know, specific purpose, as opposed to just putting it in the general fund and, well, there it goes, we spent it. I mean, it needs to be tied to something, you know, very, you know, significant and tangible, and something that you can actually follow the money trail. But at this point, you know, I feel strongly that we needed to leave that pension money there. We need to get our spending under control and you know, live within our means rather than doing these. And these were just one-time infusions. I mean, it's not like, you know, you were finding a sustainable revenue stream that you could fund something with. It was, well, we need to plug the hole for now. Well, as I said, last year we plugged the hole for a year, only to come back to plug another hole. And we're looking already, because most of what was balancing the budget as we left Olympia last week is speculative. And so, you know, we really don't have the revenue to take care of the projected expenditures. And that's very troubling to me. I mean, all the years that I was in the county and, you know, had the opportunity to put that budget together, make sure that it balanced and actually, hopefully you build a little bit of reserve just so that, you know, you're able to do, you know, what you've promised the citizens that you will do, and you'll deliver, you know, the services that people need and they've come to expect.
We've got State Senator Keith Gainer here joining us and look back to the short 60-day session. Probably the thing that seemed to get the most headlines was obviously the millionaires tax. And so it looks like we've built this program around this money that's expected, but that still has to pass the state Supreme Court. So what happens if that is actually turned down? I'm not betting that our Supreme Court would rule against it, but voters have said no 10 times in like the last century.
Well, the voters would probably turn it down. But honestly, you know, Governor Ferguson has just appointed 3 new judges. The rest of the judges were either appointed and then reelected, but by Governor Inslee. This is the same Supreme Court that says we're the only jurisdiction in the land, in the United States, that taxes capital gains as an excise tax and not income tax. So they rewrote the definition for capital gains. So I don't know that, you know, that, I mean, I'm sure there'll be a big fight, you know, and they'll put up a stiff fight because Most constitutional scholars say, well, it's pretty clear. But if you can, you know, recreate a definition for capital gains and then move into an income tax and say, well, it's only for the millionaires, which is an interesting term because there's not a clear definition of who a millionaire is. I mean, theoretically, we're saying, oh, it's only people that have made $1 million in a year. But when you start talking about all the corporations that actually have the S and Cs that actually have pass-throughs to personal income tax returns, then all of a sudden businesses that may not be making $1 million, they may look like that, but it now becomes taxable at that 9.9%. And I think what we're already hearing is people are saying we're already overburdened with taxes. I mean, when you look, I just talked to a mayor over from the west side in our district who just said that, you know, the taxes in King County, for example, are just so burdening to small business, to, you know, just to people, because the retail sales tax over in King County is over 10%. And that's already, you know, really having an impact on people. So the millionaire's tax, whether it passes or not, this budget was built on projected revenue coming in 29 and 30 for that biennium. And so, you know, as I said, that's highly speculative as to whether it will be deemed, you know, appropriate within the Constitution. And if it's not, well, then now we're in an even deeper, you know, hole.
I want to make sure that I'm understanding it, basically our Constitution says income is property, and the tax so essentially we could have an income tax, but it has to be applied uniformly. That means that you're not just talking millionaires or earnings of $1 million or more. If the court were to say, okay, it has to be applied uniformly, now we're all scared of that. Or they could say, the voters of the Constitution says you can't have an income tax. So this is what Republicans were worried about, that this uniformity could end up biting everyone if the court rules that way.
Well, most definitely, and you know, to give an example too of what the D's, the majority, were saying, there was an amendment that said this would be limited to $1 million. You know, really being specific as to what this was. That amendment was turned down because they do want the latitude to be flexible in who they tax. And, you know, the sad thing is that they're saying, well, we're trying to balance the tax system out. The reality is that, you know, we are already generating more revenue than what we had anticipated, but our spending has far outpaced that revenue. And that is what's really troubling to me, is that we are continuing to expand the size and scope of government. And it you know, I think you mentioned, you know, within off air there, that within the last decade, we have actually doubled. And our population has not doubled, because people say, well, you know, we've had this influx of people, it costs more. When you look at the size of government, the number of employees, that is one of the largest increases that we've had in our budget. Is state employees.
Yeah, $80.2 billion budget is what we will end up with. It was $38 billion in 2016. So I don't know. Has your budget doubled in the last decade? I think most people would say no.
Well, unfortunately, the expenses in farming have probably doubled, but my revenue has not.
Well, we're talking to State Senator Keith Ginter. By the way, if you have a question, Keith is always happy to try and answer that. Our studio line, 509-663-5656. And I know you kind of do listening sessions and kind of little virtual town halls during the course of the session. But by the way, have you got any of those coming up anytime soon?
We don't have them scheduled now, but we're reaching out because what I'd like to do is have them here on the east and west side.
Yeah.
Because we do need to stay as much as possible engaged and get the sense of where people are. I mean, I know how I feel and I'm not happy, but you know, we need to get feedback from people, those that are being impacted by the changes.
Well, again, if you have a question, well, we've got Senator Gaynor in studio, 509-663-5656. Let's talk about, you used to be in county government for so long. Sheriff Mike Morrison was pretty vocal about the legislation that has now basically created a commission that can decertify the election of sheriffs. And Sheriff Morrison pointed out, who's to say that that couldn't extend to other county officials? Prosecutors was at the top of his list. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on this intervention into whether or not someone can be a candidate, or that a sheriff elected by a county election could be removed or decertified.
Well, that was very troubling to me, and I was very outspoken about the lack of local control, because we've had elections since the beginning of the state for, you know, county offices, and the local citizenry, they hold their elected officials accountable, and that's why we have elections. If things aren't going well, you know, that person is probably not going to get reelected. And we've got a recall process. I mean, we've got things in place, but, you know, it's so troubling to me to hear all this talk about, you know, threats to democracy and everything. And yet what we've seen is a continual progression toward a centralization of government in Olympia. We had not only this anti-sheriff bill, the legislature gave the attorney general more authority. He can actually go in and conduct investigations without any apparent cause. I mean, it's given them complete latitude, and it's pretty far-reaching, and there was about three bills that continued to give the attorney general more authority to actually be the investigator and the prosecutor. And you know, that's a very troubling scenario for any government, to have so much of government centralized. You asked earlier about the one party. I mean, when you have the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judicial branch, you know, all of the same type of philosophy about government, where, you know, it's fine. It's kind of like having a benevolent dictator. I mean, everything's good as long as life is going good. But when things start turning, where people want to assert themselves, and in this case, like with the sheriff, they can say, well, we don't think that sheriff is interpreting the laws right. So we've got this unelected commission that has the right to withdraw or actually, you know, have the hearings and everything and decertify that individual. We have one sheriff that did get grandfathered in because the people asked him to run. He was a military veteran. He did not have the actual certification for law enforcement, but he certainly had the skill set. He had the background, and it was the Pacific County Sheriff who is there now. And he's up for re-election, and he will be able to run again. But they were targeting someone like that, where the people said, this is who we want for our sheriff. And now the state would come in and say, no, you don't. We're going to decide who you want and who you can even consider. And that, to me, is a very troubling scene for any government path that we're going.
It seemed like, when we'd hear coverage about bills up for a debate and efforts for this case, the minority party, the GOP, to try and get amendments. There really wasn't overall much success. And again, that ties into this huge margin of majority that Democrats have. And it's almost a super, I said that earlier, and you kind of corrected me a little bit, but there didn't seem to be much ability to get an amendment to these bills all over the board.
Yeah, it is very rare that a Republican idea will be accepted. It's interesting, though, many Republican ideas that were floated a couple years ago that were good ideas have come around as Democrat ideas. So it takes time. But when you're talking about bills that are actually on the floor being considered, or in committee, and that's really where the amending should be done, there's the process doesn't lend itself to good dialogue. And that's been really, you know, frustrating to me, because my previous experience was, you know, sitting with a couple other commissioners. We were responsible for a county code. You know, you'd put it together, you'd have the discussions, you'd have the public come in and weigh in, and then you'd have to live with the decision that you make. At the state level, the majority party tends to control all dialogue. And there's very little real interaction, even with the public. Yes, people do come in and testify, but you know sometimes they get less than just a minute. You know, to okay, you got 60 seconds or 90 seconds or 2 minutes is pretty generous, and to actually have a meaningful conversation and get an understanding of the people that will be impacted by that legislation, so that you're sure that when you do pursue a new course of action with in implementing a law, you have a clear understanding of who's going to be impacted. And I always have felt like that is the most important thing to do, is if we're going to change something for somebody, it's going to change their life, then we better be talking to them and get their feedback. And, you know, we'll have to make a decision at some point, and we may not agree, but at least they've had an opportunity to clearly establish, you know, what they're living with. I mean, as we see it right now from an economic standpoint, you know, people are saying, you know, this isn't working for us. You can't, you know, continue to take away from our successes and expect us to continue to be in business. I mean, we have changed so many labor laws, you know, just the technology type laws and taxes and fees that have been, you know, layered on. It has made it more increasingly difficult for people to be successful in business in the state of Washington. Actually, we went from number 7 to the latest, we're the 40th friendliest in the nation as far as business. And that's quite a drop, a significant drop.
Well, you talk about feeling as a member of the Republican minority party in both the House and the Senate that you're kind of up against a mountain that's moving towards you, I think, is the point you're making. But I understood there were about 100,000 people that signed up from the public to want to leave comment about the millionaires tax when that was being debated. And that seemed to be, sort of dismissed out of hand, or I think there were even claims that those were just bots and those weren't real people that wanted to testify about that. So this is even the public trying to express their will and kind of running up against it as though they were a member of the House or Senate from the GOP.
Well, those people that responded in a 2-3 day notice. I mean, they were pretty energized over that. So, I mean, there's probably, you know, countless thousands more that would have, you know, or, you know, had strong feelings too. But when you look at that and you see the overwhelming opposition to something that, you know, hasn't been clearly even described, I mean, that's just their initial reaction. And then to have senators, and the one senator did say, well, we really don't pay attention to the people that, you know, weigh in. Well, once again, you know, that's why you have testimony. That's why you give people an opportunity to kind of, you know, share their feelings about this policy. And if you're not going to even be listening to them, then, you know, why are we even asking, you know, in a sense? And that's sad because, you know, I've always felt like what we're trying to do is make life more, accessible, I guess, to find success and achievement in your own life, you know, by taking charge. And that's where I'm always coming from, is I'm trying to create opportunities for people to find that fulfillment that you should be able to have. We live in a great state, I mean, you know, physically, but from a political standpoint, we're making it more and more difficult for people to feel comfortable staying here.
Well, the businesses are saying they're going to leave. People are already moving. Before we get to a break, and I don't know how much longer I can keep you this hour, but just specifically for education, I think the superintendent, Chris Reichdahl, says $80 million has been cut from the education budget. I don't know what the overall general education budget is and how much $80 million is respective to that, but he's saying education's being shorthanded again.
And he's right. And that's why I wonder how long you can keep saying we need more money so that we can fund schools. I mean, that is the primary responsibility of the state of Washington. Is to have, you know, fund the schools. And then we have other, you know, government, you know, the infrastructure and those, and some of the social services are really, you know, somewhat, when I say mandated, those are actual, statutory responsibilities that we have. But when you continue to spend money on peripheral things and discretionary dollars that, that do not have a clear nexus to the Constitution or to government in general, then you can always say we need more money and then cite the things that you want to talk about. You want to talk about healthcare. You want to talk about education. You want to talk about daycare. You want to talk about, you know, taking care of the children kind of thing. But every time we've had a tax increase, those are the things that keep being mentioned. I mean, when you think about the lottery, that was set up so that we would have a funding source for education. Well, we're actually losing the percentage that is dedicated to education in our budgets. We're below 50%. We're down to like 42% now, and we were above 50%. So even as we're growing exponentially, we're not making those investments in education. We changed things about Running Start, you know, that used to be, you know, a good opportunity for kids to you know, get a jump start on college. Now they're, you know, the way the funding mechanism is working out, it's making it more difficult for that to happen. And these are the things that you know, if something's working, then why are we, you know, cutting that and trying things that are continuing to fund things that we find are not working? I don't know how many people came into my office this session and said, please don't cut, you know, our programs. And they're all programs I said, I'm fully supportive of this. You know, I don't know why we would be. I mean, we're talking about childcare. I mean, they want to talk about, oh, we're in daycare deserts and everything. And yet we have daycare providers that are saying, the state is saying they will pay us, but then they don't. You know, and I think, well, mm-hmm. Why is that not, you know, why is that not the priority? And right now, one of the goals that I have that I'm working on since we're out of session now is to find out where have those increases gone? Because whether it's Medicaid, where the state does not fully reimburse providers, whether it's for mental health, physical health, oral health. I mean, none of those people have told me that they're getting fully compensated for the services they provide. And that's very troubling to me, because those are the things we've told people you must do. You must provide this service, but we're only going to pay you a portion of what it costs.
You know, we heard about all the fraud problems in Minnesota. Do you think we have a problem? I don't know if we have more population than Minnesota and Washington. I have a feeling like maybe we do, but, you know, we're a big enough state where if there is a lot of fraud, you're talking billions of dollars.
Yeah, and I, you know, as far as the state of Washington, I don't know, and that's something I want to look into because of my role in the housing. Because we have spent literally billions of dollars on homelessness and building homes and doing all kinds of things to help the homeless, only to find the numbers increase, and we're finding people not actually being even in those facilities that are being built. So there is something that's missing in that formula. But we have an awful lot of organizations that are working and getting paid to do something, and yet it doesn't appear to be, you know, really getting the results that we're intending or hoping to see.
Well, when we come back, I want to ask about basically there's going to be a new Washington State Transmission Authority, and want to have you kind of tell us a little bit more about the Clean Energy Transformation Act. They're looking at ways to finance long district electric lines across the state. I'm kind of worried about that, how that affects us here, certainly in fire territory. So we'll get to that. Also, a little bit more about what you were able to get a couple of bills through. So can we hold you over during
sure.
the break? Appreciate it. We've got State Senator Keith Gaynor with us here on the agenda. On the agenda today, treat to get State Senator Keith Gaynor in studio with us. And I want to hear about a Washington State Transmission Authority that is going to be operating within the Commerce Department that would finance long-distance electric lines across the state. So when I asked you about this during the break, you said you're not sure what they're going to be doing. That's a little frightening.
Well, you know, the interesting thing to me is that what we have in the Western United States is a transmission authority that monitors and regulates all the power that's generated through Washington Oregon, Idaho, and British Columbia.
Isn't that the Bonneville Power Administration?
It's not. No, it's not. Bonneville is a part of that. And so Bonneville would be a producer. Chelan County PUD would be a producer. Douglas, Grant, you know, all the others. And then, of course, you know, the BPA would be through the federal dams. And so they're all part of a transmission authority, but they, the independent, like the PUDs and some of the other rural co-ops that actually sell power to their you know, clientele, then they determine what kinds of you know, power they can sell, whether it's, you know, the high load like with the data centers or any of the other things that have happened here in Chelan County, and what kind of development. Well, you know, what do they have the capacity for? Well, this Washington Transmission Authority now is going to come in, and they're going to determine how this is all going to work. And to me, you know, obviously I wasn't supportive of it, because we have people who have been in the business for years, have continued to make improvements. They have, you know, like Chelan County has a 50-year plan. I mean, they're looking to the future, and they're understanding what their, you know, loads will be here and what they can sell, you know, outside the area. And they've got tremendous, you know, power obligations to Puget Sound Energy, for example. And I think, you know, we would be so much better off to just say, let's get out of the way. Let the energy providers provide that. I mean, it's worked well. I mean, they've entered into long-term contracts. You know, people seem to be, you know, working, you know, fine, other than the fact that we do need to produce more power, and that's what they're in the business of doing. So the, when, you know, the Washington Transmission Authority could then say, oh, we need more power. Okay, well, how much power has the state of Washington produced? They don't. I mean, it's all these individual power producers that are putting the energy into the grid for people to utilize. And so to me, this is one extra step that will drive up the cost of actually delivering energy, because there was, you know, the money has to be appropriated for this authority. They, as I said, they don't have any real, they don't have a, you know, commodity to sell. Whereas, you know, these, the dam and the PUDs, they sell power, turn around and reinvest it. And in whether it be in the production or in other things that are beneficial to their communities. So I, to me, this is really not beneficial, and it'll actually, I think it'll compound things more. What we've done the last few years with CETA, which is the Clean Energy Transformation Act, and CERA, which is the Carbon Emissions Reduction Act, you know, all we've done is created more and more obstacles for power producers. I mean, they have to have the clean portfolio, which there's nothing cleaner than hydro. And yet we're finding, you know, the hydro people, they still have to, you know, invest in wind and solar, because that's the only, you know, that's kind of the going thing for renewable. But, you know, we're looking at, when I say we, I mean, as a society, we're looking at the low modular nuclear reactor type thing for providing additional power. And I think that there's real potential there. But, you know, to have the state get involved again when we have no expertise. I mean, that's not something that we've been at, you know, in on, other than regulating it. And we really need to be talking again with those power producers and say, okay, if we need to upgrade transmission lines and distribution lines, you know, what would be the most appropriate way for us as a state to help you, you know, facilitate that transition rather than dictating.
How was this session for farmers, ag producers? What came of it that you know well as a pear producer that you're concerned about?
Well, the one thing that did not happen was the collective bargaining that was out there for farm workers. It appeared that the bill was directed more toward warehousing and food processors and that type of thing, but you know, at this point, you know, this is not a time to be creating more hardship for ag in general, because agriculture nationwide is feeling, you know, pressures and, you know, financial pressures. And it's particularly in the state of Washington, when you talk to the Farm Bureau, you know, which represents all kinds of farming throughout the state, there's really not a sector that's doing well. I mean, tree fruit is struggling. The beef people are struggling. You know, some, there are some outliers within that. They've got a niche market, or, you know, they've got, they can, they're surviving okay. But the people that are the mass producers, so to speak, you know, there's really challenges. And we had another bill having to do, you know, with labor, with domestic workers. Now, if you work more than 4 hours a month, you're really entitled to have a contract with your employer. And that whole idea that not understanding the relationships that people have, and this goes back to farmers and the people that work for them. And I've told people, and I've said it on the floor numerous times, I said, you know, any success that I've had in farming has been predicated on people willing to do work that I can't do, because I have to operate enough acreage that it goes beyond, like back in the day when my dad and I were, you know, did most of our pruning and, you know, hire some guys for thinning and that kind of thing. But, you know, you have to rely on others. You have to treat them well. You have to, you know, ensure that they're satisfied so that they do a good job for you. And so for the state to come in and constantly be putting more pressure on people, making it more difficult for the employer to be successful, and as the employer is less successful, it makes it more difficult for them to take care of the very people that they want to care for, and that's their employees. So, you know, there's a lot of issues that thankfully the session is done. So we get a reprieve until next January.
Are you happy it was only 60 days in terms of, I mean, the longer the session is, doesn't it allow for more bills to be introduced that you're going to have a more difficult time getting amendments to or even trying to defeat?
Yes, and it is true. And the sad thing is, in a short session, sometimes the bill is just being developed at session. And what I mean is it hasn't really been worked in the off season, where the people that are once again being impacted have been consulted. I mean, somebody comes up with an idea and the next day it becomes a bill. The next day it's in committee. And before you know it, it's law. And you think, where did this come from? You know, and, you know, just to give you an example, you know, I'm the ranking member on the housing committee, and we're trying to find ways, to lower the cost of housing. Rather than finding money to help people pay for expensive housing, let's address what's really driving the costs. And when we've had those conversations, like last year during the process of talking with developers, one of the bills that I came up with was, you know, allowing them to postpone paying some of those upfront fees and not have to pay until they're ready to actually take advantage of them. So that's sewer and water, you know, and so it would be delaying connection fees. And it just would make sense from a financial standpoint for a developer, but it didn't make it through. I mean, I got it out of committee, but it died, you know, in the rules. And so it didn't get pulled to actually be considered. But it's those kinds of things that have to happen, where we're talking with people, knowing what would make a difference in order to bring down the cost, the high cost that I feel like we've really driven in this state.
That shouldn't be a partisan a bickering point, trying to bring costs down for housing. We need more.
Exactly. And that's part of the problem, is that the people that could be doing the work and would like to be doing the work, you know, if... what we're doing is really pricing a lot of people out. I mean, what I mean by that is that in the old days, you know, you'd have some lower, when I say lower end, lower priced homes, it would be a starter home. I mean, you don't hear much about starter homes anymore. People right now, the kinds of homes that are being built are design build. I mean, people, they get their contractors. So it's always more the higher end homes that are getting built. And there's plenty of construction that is going on, because some people, you know, have the money to do that. But what we really would like to do is make sure that people are given a fair start, you know, an opportunity for a fair start in raising their family. And then, you know, as they become more financially stable and have some equity in their home, they can make that step up to a little bigger home, a little different neighborhood, whatever. But, you know, anymore, everything is so prohibitively expensive that it's difficult for anyone to get started.
Did we get a little bit of a rollback on the estate taxes in our state, you know, for farmers, maybe that, you know, are have had that family legacy, that family farm. Did that get scaled back a little bit?
It did. So it's not quite as expensive to die in Washington. So instead of 35% of, you know, the larger estates going, they did roll it back. So it's at 20%.
How did that happen?
Well, they realized that when that happened last year, that we didn't think we were going to be such an outlier. And that was the terminology that Senator Peterson used. And so they realized, well, there are other places, other states that are at 20%. So we can at least go back to 20. And that's where it ended up.
We haven't talked really about any social issues, but there were two initiatives to the legislature group that was able to, I think, get signatures enough to get them to the legislature. The one had to do with basically parental rights again. And number two is girls' sports. When it's initiative to the legislature, that's a different process than the Citizens Initiative, which just gets it onto the ballot in November. So what happened with both of those?
Well, they got postponed. And the sad thing about that is that when you read the Washington State Constitution, it says that initiatives to the legislature should take highest priority. And, but once again, you know, when you're in such a minority, it's hard to, you know, how are you going to hold somebody accountable to, hey, you're not interpreting the Constitution right, or the Constitution says this. And they just say, well, we'll just put it on the ballot. So you will see it on the ballot in November, but it should have been dealt with by constitutional decree. It should have been dealt with in the legislative session.
So the legislature either has to accept them or be on record with a vote. And, of course, then people have to reveal how they feel about that particular issue,
right.
But they can kind of punt in this case, and it goes to the November ballot.
Well, I don't know the total legality of what was done, but they refused to give it a hearing, even in committee, and they just passed it on to the ballot. Say, well, we'll put it to the people.
Well, let's give you a chance to talk a little bit about you had some successes with some bills that you sponsored.
I did, and they were bills that they're not going to be earth-shattering things, but I think they do have some promise. And one just raised the level of what you could surplus if you're a water or sewer district. So, like I said, it doesn't apply to a lot of people, but to the water and sewer districts, it was important to them. I was also asked to sponsor a bill for PUDs, which would allow them to do more work in-house. And what they were finding was that because the bid limits were so low, that it was really kind of hindering them from actually getting projects underway. And the bill got amended to only include clean energy projects, but that in some ways that's okay, as long as the local PUD, it can do things outside of having to go out for bid. And because it costs more, there's more of a delay with going out to bid. But if they did it all in-house, one of the concerns was labor, were the labor unions going to be concerned? And all of the PUDs have union labor within their organizations. So, we're making sure that, the people that need to be, engaged are going to be able to do that. And it will be much more beneficial in having things done and get online a lot sooner than going through the previous process.
We're talking to State Senator Keith Gaynor from the 12th District, and used to be a Chelan County Commissioner. And so I remember when you decided to run, that was one of the main things that you wanted to go to Olympia, is to kind of help protect counties, because you used to sit on those boards. And now you've got several counties that you get to. Well, I guess it's just really technically Chelan and over in
King and Snohomish.
You stretch into King, a little bit of Snohomish now.
Mm-hmm.
So you got three county commissions that you're looking out for. But what do Chelan County commissioners have to worry about as of this latest session? Like any new environmental or governmental regulations that the county commissioners are going to have to figure out how to pay for?
I think actually, there weren't any real changes this session. I sit on local government and the housing and transportation. So I mean, I kind of keep an eye on those things that would be impacting local governments, because I'm very concerned about the state continuing to layer more and more responsibility on the cities and counties. The counties are sub-agents of the state. You know, they do so much. You know, the assessor assesses all the property and the state collects the tax, you know, and the treasurer collects the tax for the state. And yet we don't, when I say we, the state doesn't compensate those cities and counties for that function. So, and there, you know, whether it's the licensing one that is really terribly poorly funded is the public defense. I mean, the counties have to pick up the tab for defending those felonies that are actually the responsibility of the state. That's been an issue for years. And yet that was also on the table to actually find more funding for public defense. But somehow I guess the counties made it another year, so we're going to tell them to do it again next year kind of thing. And so when you talk, like I had an opportunity to go to the State of the Cities yesterday and listen to the city of Wenatchee and East Wenatchee talk about their issues. Once again, these are very responsible mayors and city councils that are living within their means. And, you know, at the county level, the commissioners, they have to live within their means. At the state level, it seems like we continue to expand our means and then now go find revenue to pay for what we want to do, rather than saying, you know, we need to make sure that we're not taking, you know, expanding our scope again of what our responsibilities are. Make sure that we're taking care of those core things. I mean, you know, for me at the state level, one of the core functions is the infrastructure, transportation. We continue to not adequately fund. Yes, we did some bonding for specifically for bridges, because we've got 300 bridges that are in dire state of repair. We've got three bridges out in the basin that right across I-90 that are being closed because they can't handle their loads, and yet we're not really making that a priority. And that those are concerns that I have, that we don't prioritize our spending.
Well, just a final thought for me on this session and what you hope to hear from folks between now and heading back to Olympia coming up in January.
Well, I'm always looking for people that, you know, are willing to express their opinion, whether they agree with me or not. And I've always felt that it was important for me to have a clear understanding, because I don't have the experience of all the things. And that's what's so amazing to me, is the diversity of our, not only our district, but of our state, the different types of industries and, businesses that we have. And there's always somebody coming up with a new idea. But with those new ideas, they have to make that idea fit within the structure that's put in place. And so, you know, if I can help them either, you know, change the structure enough that allows them to do what they need to do, because somebody didn't envision that this law was going to impact someone else's opportunity for providing a service, a great benefit, you know, then I need to know those kinds of things. So I welcome the input, and I hope people feel comfortable reaching out and sharing their concerns. And
how do they reach your office here during, in between session here over the course of the rest of this year and before you head back?
Well, they can either just email my office, or if they go to, Keith Gaynor, GOP, I think it is, at the state level, or keith.gaynor@ledge.wa.gov, we'll be happy to. I'm very easy to find on the internet, so.
Yeah, just Google it and you'll get right to Senator Gaynor, the 12th district. You're getting a chance probably to do this over in the other side of the mountains as well with the communities there. They're probably facing their own issues, and that 12th district is so broad now, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting how Highway 2, starts in Everett, but we pick it up in Monroe, comes all the way through here. So, I mean, that's a common thread. And during the December storms, I mean, there was some real impacted communities, not only on Highway 2, but then to the south part of our district, which is in the Snoqualmie, North Bend area, in Falls City. You know, they were all significantly impacted. So, you know, we certainly have a lot of common interests, but there are a lot of things that are very distinctly different about the three different counties that we represent.
All right. Thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thanks, Dave.
Your State Senator, Keith Gaynor from the 12th District.